Yes, I'm going to talk about one aspect of accurately measuring par. And before I get to the guts of my talk, here's a brief outline. I'll provide some motivation for why I chose this topic, some background, so definition of what par is, and then the sensor options for measuring par, spectroradiometers and quantum sensors. We'll look at some spectral response data and errors for different sensors, specifically commercial quantum sensors that are available on the market, and then we'll summarize by comparing quantum sensors and spectroradiometers. So there's lots of different radiation sources used to grow plants, and traditionally we've used sunlight and broadband electric light sources, and I'm showing the major ones here. Of course, the sun, high-pressure sodium, metal halide, and fluorescent lamps. I don't think there's any question that LEDs are becoming very, very common, especially in research applications, but even in some commercial applications. There was a session this morning about vertical farming. There was a lot of discussion about LEDs there. The picture that I'm showing you here is actually at the research greenhouses at Utah State University. These are small growth chambers, and the one closest to you there is a broadband LED, so it's white light. Then you can see a narrow band chamber that's green, another one that's blue, another one that's red, and behind that, if you can see it, there's kind of a pink or purpley colored one that's a mix of red and blue. So that's one difference between LEDs and a lot of the traditional electric lights we've used. They're narrow band, so they can potentially be tricky to measure. And I can't speak for the other companies that are building PAR sensors, but at Apogee, we often get the question, how do I measure LEDs, or can I accurately measure LEDs using quantum sensors? And so I want to try to address that question along with just the overall question of how accurate are quantum sensors under all these different light sources that we use to grow plants. But before I do, I want to talk about the definition of PAR, photosynthetically active radiation. So this graph here shows the photosynthetic efficiency of plants, essentially. The y-axis is relative quantum yield, or just on a relative scale, photosynthesis divided by the photons absorbed by the plant. And on the x-axis is the wavelength. These data are the mean for 22 different species, and they were measured by Keith McCree in 1972. And what you see is that not all photons are equally efficient in generating photosynthesis in plants. There's a big peak around 600 nanometers, and then another secondary peak around 400-420 nanometers. So one potential definition of PAR, photosynthetically active radiation, is just measuring the spectral output of a light source using a spectroradiometer, where you get intensity at multiple different wavelengths, and then you weight it according to these weighting factors that McCree generated, and you sum up the result. And we called that yield photon flux density, and the units are micromoles per meter squared per second. And that may be a fine way to quantify photosynthetically active radiation, but there's a couple potential issues with that. One of them is that these data were collected on single leaves under low light intensities and over short time scales. So does this curve look the same for whole plants or entire plant canopies growing in the field or in the greenhouse under higher light levels and over longer time scales? Maybe not. But perhaps a bigger issue or a larger challenge is you actually have to have a sensor that represents closely or approximates that curve shown there. And that's not trivial, unless, of course, you're making a spectral measurement, so you have measurements at multiple wavelengths and can weight the data by this curve. So an alternative definition of photosynthetically active radiation is just to assume equal weighting of all of the photons between 400 and 700 nanometers, and we sum them up. That's called photosynthetic photon flux density, or PPFD. Turns out the exact same year that Keith McCree published the green curve, He also found that defining PAR as PPFD, or equal weighting to all the photons between 400 and 700 nanometers, is an accurate measurement of photosynthetically active radiation. And the correlation of YPFD to photosynthesis and PPFD to photosynthesis were very, very similar. And so since that time, these black weighting factors shown on the graph have actually been widely used and adopted as the definition for photosynthetically active radiation. These data here show why the correlation of both of these measures, PPFD and YPFD, are highly correlated to photosynthesis. Because if one of them is correlated to photosynthesis, the other one should be, because they're very, very highly correlated to each other. The y-axis is yield photon flux density, the x-axis is photosynthetic photon flux density, and then the individual points are lots of different light sources, both sunlight and electric lights. And you can see the r-squared value is 0.999. And the relationship is that yield photon flux density is roughly 90% of photosynthetic photon flux density. So if we can measure one of the two, we can fairly accurately estimate the other one. So the take-home message of this slide is that it doesn't really matter which one you measure, they're both very closely related. So the goal then is to produce a sensor that as closely matches the PPFD weighting factors as possible. And we call those sensors quantum sensors. And I'll talk a bit about quantum sensors first, and then we'll cover another sensor that's used to measure PAR as well. So a quantum sensor is a broadband device, meaning it has a single detector that's sensitive to all of the wavelengths that are incident on it. And in front of that detector, we put a filter, and the purpose of the filter is to try to approximate this curve right here, or these weighting factors. And so what you get with a quantum sensor is one signal that's proportional to the spectrum of the light being measured, weighted by the spectral response of the sensor itself, where that spectral response is determined by the filter and then the broadband detector. So it's a simple device, easy to use. They tend to be lower cost. The catch is you only get PAR, you only get photosynthetically active radiation. Spectroradiometers, on the other hand, are hyperspectral devices, meaning they measure multiple wavelengths independently, and often the resolution can be quite high, on the order of a nanometer for the good ones. So they consist of a device to separate the light, the broadband light, into individual wavelengths. Here I'm showing a prism, but a diffraction grating is commonly used as well. And then behind that device that separates the light is a whole array of detectors. So the individual wavelengths strike a different point on the detector array. And as long as the individual detectors on the array are accurately calibrated, then we can get a perfect match to those black weighting factors that I showed on the previous slide, because the calibration of each detector on the array essentially determines the spectral response of the spectroradiometer. So they're more sophisticated devices than quantum sensors, and traditionally they were tricky to use and they were really expensive. In recent years, the ease of use has improved significantly and the cost has come down quite a bit. They're still quite a bit more expensive than quantum sensors, but the real advantage is not only do you get photosynthetically active radiation, you also get the spectrum of the light source that you're measuring. So I'm going to actually show you the spectral responses of multiple different commercial quantum sensors. So essentially how well the filter and detector combination for different quantum sensors matches the weighting factors for PPFD. This is the Kippen-Zonin model PQS1. Here's the LIKOR model LI190, the Apogee model SQ120, and the Apogee model SQ150. I'm only showing four models here because these are the four that I actually have at our facility at Apogee in Logan, Utah, that I've actually measured with our monochromator. There's a lot more companies that are building these sensors, and I can't measure them all and put them all on the graph, but these are some of the most common for research purposes. So of all of these, three of them match the defined black weighting factors fairly well, the Kippen Zone and the Licor and the Apogee Model SQ500 all do a pretty good job of matching those black weighting factors, meaning the spectral error, which is caused by mismatch of the sensor's spectral response and the black weighting factors, should be relatively low. But in the case where there is significant mismatch between the sensor spectral response and the photosynthetic photon flux density weighting factors, it results in spectral errors. So just to give you an example of that, here I've pictured only the PPFD weighting factors and the spectral response for the Apogee model SQ120. You can see it is sensitive to some of the ultraviolet wavelengths, less than 400 nanometers. It underweights a little bit in the blue. It overweights a little bit right in the middle of the visible range from about 450 to about 650. And then it cuts off about 655, 660 nanometers, and it's not sensitive to those deep red wavelengths above about 655 nanometers. So if we were to use this Apogee sensor to measure a red and blue LED where the red LED had a peak around 670, the sensor's not sensitive to a lot of the radiation being output by this particular LED, because it cuts off about 655 and the LED peaks about 670. So back in the mid-60s, Federer and Tanner developed a relatively simple way to calculate spectral errors from quantum sensors with three pieces of information. We need the spectral response of the sensor. That's the S term in the equation, and that one, for in this example, it would be the blue data. We need the spectral output of the light we're measuring. That's the I measurement term in this equation, and that's the red data in this example. And then we also need to know the spectral output of the light source that we're measuring. And that will be different for different manufacturers of quantum sensors. And when I show data, I've assumed the same lamp type for all quantum sensors so they can be compared on a relative scale. But what I'm about to show is what are the results. If we take this equation and these spectral responses for these different quantum sensors, and we plug in the data for these quantum sensors and multiple different types of light that we might measure in the real world, what do we get? And here are the results. So as I mentioned before, I've bolded cool white fluorescent. We assumed that all the sensors were calibrated to cool white fluorescent just so that they were all on the same relative scale. And you can see, looking down the columns, the errors are quite low, aside from using the Apogee model SQ120 to measure LED light sources that have a lot of deep red radiation. So the real take-home message that I want to convey is that you have to be careful with using quantum sensors to measure light sources for plants, but ultimately they work quite well. So when customers call up and ask us, can we use these things to measure LEDs? The answer is yes, assuming 5 or 6% error is reasonable, then yeah, you can use quantum sensors to measure light emitting diodes and other types of plant light sources. If errors on the order of 5 to 6% in terms of spectral error are unacceptable, then the spectroradiometer is the alternative. So as I said before, as long as the detector array and the spectroradiometer is accurately calibrated for all of the wavelengths, spectral error should be zero for a spectroradiometer. And so one new product that Apogee has been working on, I actually have one more slide before I get there. I should mention that LIGHTCOR has recently released a new quantum sensor. It's called the model LI-190R. I actually have not measured one of these with our monochromator at Apogee, so I didn't have data in the table to show you. But the spectral response is quite good in terms of matching the defined photosynthetic photon flux density weighting factors. And so the errors for this sensor should be even better than the errors for the previous version of LIGHTCOR sensor. One thing that we have been working on at Apogee is a small, lightweight, and low-cost spectroradiometer that can be used to measure plant lighting. Here's a picture of it under a red and blue LED. Here's a picture of it next to a couple common quantum sensors to give you a really good idea of what the size of the instrument is. And I can say we're getting close to releasing the product. We hope to be done before now. And as often goes with development of new things, the goal gets pushed back as you learn more about performance and have issues to work out along the way. So, coming soon. So to conclude, to compare and contrast quantum sensors and spectroradiometers, yes, quantum sensors are subject to spectral error, and spectroradiometers are not. And yes, quantum sensors are a broadband measurement, so you only get PAR, whereas with a spectroradiometer, it's a hyperspectral measurement, so you get PAR and the spectrum. But quantum sensors have the advantage of being simpler, and the particular advantage is much lower cost. For the most part, quantum sensors are going to be $500 or less, whereas spectroradiometers, a good price for a spectroradiometer would be the lower end of the range that I've shown here. So again, there's lots of commercial quantum sensors available that can measure LEDs and other light sources accurately, as long as 5%-ish is a reasonable degree of error. And one more really important point, this should be, the final take-home message, is that my talk only covered spectral errors. That's not the only error, the source of error that you have to consider when you're making radiation measurements. These sensors are going to be subject to calibration errors, angular or cosine errors, temperature errors. We could easily put together an individual presentation for each one of these other sources of error. So there's lots of things to consider, and you need to be careful, but ultimately it's possible to make accurate measurements with the technology available, and we hope to continue to improve technology going forward. Here are a few references for that. That's all I had. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions. So how long do these quantum sensors last? Can you put them in a greenhouse or a growth chamber for months and months and months with solar radiation plus your LED lights and expect them to live for a couple of years?
Well, I think the answer to that question is not all sensors are created equal. Some of them are going to suffer from different challenges, but kind of as a general rule, at least for the sensors that I've documented in my presentation, the manufacturers will specify that the stability is typically, the drift is less than 2% per year, which is pretty good. And I don't think you would find that specification for all products available. And I don't know that you would find that specification holds, or whatever is specified for certain products might not actually hold for all products. But typically they are built to be weatherproof, meaning if they get wet, it shouldn't cause a problem. If it's a high temperature or a high humid environment, or if your temperature is cycling significantly, it shouldn't cause a problem. But it is good practice to periodically check the calibration of your instruments. So, for example, there's some greenhouse and growth chamber working groups that have an actual instrument package where it's four LIGHTCOR sensors that have a calibration attached to them every 6 months or so. And then they send this package around to different facilities within the group so they can periodically check the calibration of the sensors in their grow chambers and in their greenhouses to verify that, yes, the sensor hasn't drifted.